You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to a new episode of Locked On Rockets, your home for podcast analysis of all things Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent for Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. As we chat on this Thursday evening, August 30th, that's a fun date for me to say because it reminds me that we're barely over 24 hours away from the calendar moving to September, which in NBA circles is the start of the new league year. That means you're just over 3 weeks away, actually maybe under 3 weeks away this year with the regular season starting earlier than ever. That gives more time for the league to space out games, more rest, fewer back-to-backs, those types of things. Point is, we're very, very close to the opening of training camp. The Rockets will get going earlier than that with a trip to the Bahamas, I believe, next week to serve as a training camp before the training camp. We are not very far away from getting to put these players on the basketball floor, most of the returning core from last year's 65-17 squad that went to Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals, then lost Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute in the offseason, but added James Ennis and Carmelo Anthony, among others. Now, if you're a regular listener of Locked On Rockets, you know I'm pretty optimistic about what the Rockets have done this offseason, perhaps more optimistic than most in terms of the Ennis and Melo versus Ariza and Luke Bamute swap, and also a few other fringe players they added, clearly Michael Carter-Williams, DeAnthony Melton or two that presumably could have roles. But also, I'm optimistic they do have further avenues for improvement, the mid-level exception for buyouts during the season, Ryan Anderson's $20 million salary as a potential filler in trades for another 3-and-D wing. The bottom line is, I'm optimistic. There are others, however, especially nationally, that are somewhat less so. One of those that might fit that criteria is ESPN's Kevin Pelton. And we're going to hear from Kevin shortly on today's show. He was actually a guest today on Locked On NBA, which is the national show covering the NBA as a whole on this Locked On Podcast Network. It's hosted by David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, and effectively the godfather of this entire network. But on today's show, he had Kevin as his guest, and Kevin is largely discussing, if you want to check out that show again, Locked On NBA for Kevin's full comments, but Kevin Pelton of ESPN is discussing his summer forecast, and his summer forecast on ESPN is based on a formula derived from ESPN's real plus minus or RPM statistic. It's a good time of year for those discussions, as I've said in recent days, because now that you're still a couple of weeks away at least from training camp, this is the last time we'll have a chance to actually do some bigger picture thinking before the season, how these teams stack up with one another before we get into the nitty-gritty of training camp, rotation updates, the start of preseason games, and so on and so forth. Anyway, Kevin has a system that, based on the various real plus-minus figures for each team, and real plus-minus is a very quality stat that I know a lot of NBA front offices use as part of their analytics package. Anyway, based on that, you may have already seen the graphic that ESPN put out a couple of weeks ago. It actually has the Utah Jazz, not the Houston Rockets, as the number two seed in the Western Conference behind Golden State. Now, in fairness to Kevin Pelton, who, again, ESPN writer, does a great job, it's not necessarily his personal projections. This is formula-driven, and that's why I didn't get particularly up in arms when I saw the prediction a couple of weeks ago, because it's not like someone is actually saying that's going to happen. This is the formula, so that's only one part of the equation. Of course, in real life, these types of analytics forecasts are blended with input from human beings, the eye test, if you will. And that leads to, well, what happens on the floor. Or at least breaking down what happens on the floor, I should say. Anyway, as part of the Locked On NBA episode between David Locke and Kevin Pelton, the two got into it as far as Houston's ranking, why the system puts Utah slightly in front, again, very close. The average differential is less than one win. But when you consider these two teams were separated by 17 games this past season, Rockets at 65 wins, the Jazz at 48, Rockets also dispatched the Jazz 4-1 in the second round of the playoffs, it's definitely eye-raising. I didn't want to overreact when I saw it first come out on Twitter that the Jazz were in the number two spot, because again, it's just a formula. I wanted to hear from Kevin himself to explain it a little more, the factors that went into it, and that's what they did on today's show. So first, I'm going to play back the segment between Locke and Pelton as they discuss the Rockets versus the Jazz and the system, what the factors are that have the Jazz in the Rockets neighborhood, if not slightly ahead. And then from there, on the other side, I'm going to give my analysis, which, as you guys can guess, is slightly less friendly about the Jazz and particularly how they stack up with the Rockets. Before we get to that, though, let's play back the conversation between David Locke and Kevin Pelton.
Western Conference, we talked about the Lakers already, Kevin, and that they were a little bit. What does Carmelo's impact to the Rockets and the loss of Bob Mute and Trevor Ariza do to the Rockets?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's much more about the loss of Ariza and Bob Mute than it is Melo. I mean, I didn't look at when I first started plugging in the RPM projections, it was already pretty clear that Melo was going to Houston, although he hadn't officially signed. So he's been included in them the whole time. But I don't know that they'd be appreciably different without him. I mean, I think a lot of what Houston is looking at is, you know, can we replace 80% of what Trevor Ariza did at about 10% of the price in terms of guys making the veteran minimum with James Ennis and Melo as compared to the $15 million that Ariza got in Phoenix. And, you know, that's probably true, but that 20% does end up being an important difference, you know, especially when you're talking about kind of the fine differences between the top teams in the league.
The switching defense, can you run it with a bad defensive – like, their beauty was they didn't have bad defensive players other than Ryan Anderson. And if you look at their numbers with Ryan Anderson on the floor, they weren't good. They just stopped playing him, though. Can they do this with not very good with a bad defensive player on the floor the same way they did last year?
And the fascinating thing is that Oklahoma City's numbers on switches last year involving Carmelo Anthony were actually quite good. I mean, this is something I wrote about when Melo signed with Houston. The second spectrum data that we have access to at ESPN shows that, you know, he was well above average in terms of plays where he switched what the opponent's scoring was. And I think that's probably more testament to the other players around him in Oklahoma City than it is Melo individually. But, you know, he is still going to have that same kind of strong support system and infrastructure in Houston. And I think sometimes, you know, we remember what happens in the playoffs where Utah in particular just did an incredible job of targeting Melo in switches in that first round matchup and picked him apart as the numbers reflect. But teams don't tend to play him that way over the course of the regular season, so I don't think it's going to be as big an issue for them during the regular season.
All right. You have Utah's number two. That, I think, surprised people.
For sure.
How come?
I mean, you know, you look at the team that finished last season that they bring back, you know, virtually intact, and, you know, they were playing at that level or even higher during the second half of the season. And, you know, while you can't necessarily expect that to continue entirely, you know, I think that the addition of Jay Crowder, as you've talked about, the subtraction of Joe Johnson and Rodney Hood, who are negatives in terms of plus minus, give them the opportunity to, you know, continue playing at a somewhat similar level over the course of this season. And I think the other thing I'd say here is that, you know, if you read these RPM projections and really any projections, it is probably somewhat less important who's second or third and more important, you know, what kind of the relative win totals are. So Houston and Utah, you know, it's a difference of 0.4 games on average. So, you know, probably 40 to 45% of the time, the Rockets are going to end up with a better record than the Jazz. But it's just that on average, Utah does come out slightly ahead.
So first off, a few thoughts on the Rockets-specific analysis laid out by Kevin Pelton in his chat with David Locke on Locked On NBA. As far as Carmelo defensively, the metrics on his switches, he's correct. The Thunder were not a bad team when switching with Carmelo Anthony on the floor, at least in the regular season. Now, the data was much more mixed in the playoffs, but I think you could mount a pretty convincing case that the relationship between the Thunder and Carmelo, particularly the coaching staff at Carmelo, had really soured by the start of the playoffs in mid-April. And by that point, you might have had some effort, some focus issues from a clearly unhappy Carmelo that would not necessarily be the case in Houston, where Carmelo is presumably going to be much happier and much more fulfilled in terms of his role and buying into the system. It's possible that a better attitude could fix some of those things that went wrong for Carmelo defensively in the playoffs, in my opinion. But overall, we're talking about the regular season here. The bigger priority is over 82 games. Can the Rockets get a top two seed again? Ideally, the number one. And it seems Kevin's in agreement with the data that Carmelo, as long as he's supported by a strong defensive group, which he was in Oklahoma City, with Steven Adams, Paul George, at times Andre Robertson, and clearly will be here in Houston as well, you can survive with him over 82 games. That's the bigger takeaway in terms of this discussion of can anyone compete with the Rockets for a top two seed. And secondly, look, we've been around the bush so many times in terms of Carmelo and James Ennis versus Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute. I know Kevin hit those themes again, and I don't fully agree with his assessment or the league as a whole. I sense from Twitter that a lot of Rockets fans agree with me. But look, we've been around the block on this for a couple of months now, and we've said all that we can say. And as far as Ennis and Melo versus Ariza and Bamute, there's not really going to be much more that can be said about it until the games start happening, which thankfully is just a few short weeks away. And then we get some data sets on how these new guys play in Houston and how the departed to fare elsewhere. To me, that angle is a bit boring because with those playing up those as significant losses for the Rockets, at this point, we're just going to have to agree to disagree and pick back up when the games start rolling and we actually have new data come in. That said, if you actually listen to Kevin's analysis, it seems pretty clear that his assessment of the Jazz being a threat to the Rockets, even slightly ahead, although very, very close, according to his RPM projections. And again, it's worth noting that the projections are formula-driven. It's not Kevin saying that this is exactly what he thinks is going to happen. It's him explaining, essentially, why his formula spits out these results. But with that disclaimer considered, it's pretty clear that it's less about Houston and it's more about Utah. It's more buying into the fact that Utah, which started the year 19-28 last year before finishing on that crazy 29-6 kick, the idea is that if they pick up where they left off, the final 35 games of the regular season, and you extrapolate that over 82 games or even something close to that winning percentage, then yeah, they are in the neighborhood of Houston and Golden State, and they could presumably be a third team to jump into that top tier, which definitely changes the championship odds, the math for the Rockets, and, well, also for the Warriors, for that matter. And when you look at things purely through the lens of statistics, I understand where it's coming from. It's not just that the Jazz finished 29-6, it's that they largely dominated in that stretch. Not just winning games, but it wasn't like they were just getting a bunch of 2-3-point wins. They were absolutely obliterating teams for a large portion of the final 2.5 months of the season. They looked like a juggernaut. So I understand why the metrics like them that much, and because the metrics like them a lot, I think that's part of why you're seeing people around the NBA put the Jazz as a consensus top three team, and even some having the nerve to ask whether they're a top two team. However, in my opinion, this entire concept is a good reminder of why, while data is important, I'm certainly a big believer in analytics, it also needs to be blended with the eye test. And to me, it's the eye test where the Jazz fall short. And I said that in my ranking of the West in my podcast a couple of weeks back, that I don't really see the Jazz or anybody else for that matter having enough to close what was a 17-game gap between Utah and Houston this past season. The closest team besides Golden State to the Rockets was Portland, who was 16 back. That's a massive gap. I don't really see the Jazz or anyone else being able to overcome that. Now, if you believe that 29-6 close can be extrapolated, that winning percentage, that they just magically found something and that it's going to continue, then yeah, you could certainly make the argument, and I think that's what some of the systems are sniffing out. But in my opinion, this is a case where you do need to look at factors just beyond the data and consider that maybe there's a little bit misleading there. For starters, we saw these two teams, the Rockets and the Jazz, on the floor in the playoffs. The Rockets won 4 of the 5 games. Of the 4 games they won, 2 were in blowouts. The one loss they had was clearly an outlier in terms of their defensive intensity being laughable. Really, that and Game 3 against Minnesota, the two outliers of the entire playoff run for the Rockets. By and large, they dominated that series, including a Game 3 in Utah that they could have won by 50 had they wanted to. A Game 4 in Utah that, while a little bit close, we found out after the series that James Harden was sick the final 2 games, those were his worst of the playoffs. Game 4, even when it was a little bit closer, the Rockets still led throughout. And while you could point to the fact that the Jazz were without Ricky Rubio, you could also point to the fact that the Rockets were, for all intents and purposes, without Luke Bamute. Now, I know in terms of his physical body, he was out there, but clearly, as evidenced by the Warriors series, he was not himself. In the Jazz series, Bamute averaged fewer than 20 minutes per game, shot 33% from the field, and just 20% from three. The Rockets were clearly the better team in that five-game series, and they did it not just with Chris Paul and James Harden on the offensive end of the floor, but defensively, they largely suffocated the Jazz, especially when it mattered. Again, game two, the obvious outlier. But Utah, for all their strengths defensively, led by Rudy Gobert, for the incredible coaching by Quinn Snyder, who I view as top three in the entire NBA, they have a lot of positives. Offensively, there's really just one clearly above-average scorer creator. That's Donovan Mitchell. And as far as I saw it on the court, there just was not the same playmaking potential on one side of the floor for Utah compared to what Houston had with Chris Paul and James Harden. Sometimes the game really can be that simple. That said, even though they lost in five games, and in fairness to the Jazz, they did not have Ricky Rubio, but we do want to acknowledge the fact they were 29-6 to finish the year. That was real. That was an incredible run, although they also lost to the Rockets on February 26th, in the middle of that, when the Rockets were on the second night of a back-to-back, front end in Denver, second end in Utah, both at altitude. So even in the regular season, it's not like Utah had much success against the Rockets. That said, there was one contender they did have success against. That was the Golden State Warriors. Three times in the final 2.5 months, the Jazz beat the Warriors, every time by 19 or more points. And at face value, that gives some credibility to their 29-6 run, because you're saying, well, look, they're beating the Warriors. It's not like they're just beating up on bad teams. Here's one of the cream of the crop, actually the cream of the crop, the now back-to-back defending champions. And the Jazz didn't just beat them. They destroyed them on three separate occasions. However, I would throw some cold water on that, because to me, it seems clear that the Golden State Warriors at the playoffs, the champion Warriors, that was not what we saw down the stretch of the season. Now, part of it was injury-related, and the Warriors were missing some key pieces for some of those minutes against the Jazz in those three games. But quite frankly, even when the Warriors weren't hurt, and some or most of their big guns were out there, it was obvious down the stretch of the year that once they realized that the Rockets could not be caught, that they had no shot at a one seed, it was pretty clear that the Warriors essentially went into self-preservation mode, not wanting to expend a lot of energy, believing they could flip the switch in the playoffs. And guess what? They were right. They did. And I suppose kudos to them for that. But as far as the Jazz are concerned, if you take away those Warriors games, if you don't give them what it would seem at face value in terms of statement marquee wins, if we accept the fact that the Warriors down the stretch of the regular season are not truly the Warriors, then how impressive was that stretch really? Because the games that really mattered, mentioned they lost to the Rockets. They also lost to the Celtics. The season finale, the Jazz were in Portland. That was a game that had very high stakes. The winner, I believe, winning the division title and getting home court advantage in the first round. The loser not. The Jazz lost that game and really weren't even that close. From the All-Star break onward, if we discount the Warriors games, here's who the Jazz beat. Dallas, Minnesota without Jimmy Butler, Sacramento, Orlando, Indiana, Memphis, New Orleans, Detroit, Phoenix, Sacramento, Dallas again, Memphis again, Minnesota again without Jimmy Butler, the Lakers twice, and the Clippers. Look, outside of Indiana and New Orleans, that is not a good list at all. Now, to the credit of the Jazz, you can only handle what's on your schedule. They took care of business, and they deserve immense credit for that. However, in terms of predictive value, I don't know that that indicates that they are truly at the level of a Houston or Golden State or an upper-tier team in the NBA. In my opinion, the Jazz, because of the disciplined style with which they play, the incredible coaching of Quinn Snyder, to me, they are a nightmare or perhaps a dream for teams that are tanking. Because the teams that are tanking, and that's especially what happens the final 2 months of the season or so, what you see more than anything are young players who are undisciplined. You contrast that with a Jazz team who plays so slow, so deliberate, such a contrast from others around the NBA, rarely takes any plays off, and in my opinion, it's the perfect storm for essentially the more disciplined team to rack up wins. And boy, did they. However, at the end of the day, there's still only one above average playmaker, and that's Donovan Mitchell. And even for all of Mitchell's success, if you follow me on Twitter at Ben DuBose, you know that I'm a huge supporter of Donovan, but he's a rookie. There are often second-year slumps, and I think to some degree success as a rookie can come because there's not that much of a scouting report. You can catch the league by surprise. Now he's going to have to adjust to the adjustments. That's not meant to diminish the Jazz at all. They're a very good team. I enjoy watching them, specifically because of how well they are coached. It would not surprise me if they're the best team in the West outside of Houston and Golden State. But to put them in that top tier, I know what the data, I know what the models are seeing in terms of the data, but sometimes you have to go a step beyond just the models and use the eye test. And from what I've seen, the Jazz against truly upper echelon teams, even that playoff series against the Thunder, very easily could have gone the other way. And that, of course, followed by the five-game loss to the Rockets. I think the Jazz are a very good team, but I think the data is a little misleading. I also think you can't completely discount the first 47 games of the year when they went 19-28 either. So in closing, while I understand what the model is seeing, to me, when you look harder, I don't see, when you compare the Jazz and the Rockets, or the Jazz and the Warriors for that matter, by the eye test, that you can see the Jazz in that class. And in defense of ESPN's Kevin Pelton, he might honestly see it the same way. Again, these are not his personal projections. These are basically a formula calculated from ESPN's real plus-minus stat. But formula or not, the graphics out there, we've all seen ESPN share it with the Jazz at number 2 in the West, the Rockets at number 3. It's out there. Now we have a little bit more insight from Kevin on why the model is projecting that. And so with his statements coming out today on Locked On NBA, I thought it was an appropriate time for me to respond why I don't really see it as all that intimidating as far as the Rockets are concerned entering this upcoming season. Now, to wrap up the show quickly, I know this is the end of August. It's technically the dog days of the NBA calendar, but there are a couple of dates over the next week that I think NBA fans, including here in Houston, do need to be aware of that could possibly serve as an impetus for increased activity. One of them we've covered before, and that's the September 5th deadline. That's next Wednesday, I believe, and that's when teams are required to give a tender offer, basically the one-year minimum, to their second-round picks in order to retain their rights. In the case of the Rockets, that applies to rookie guard D'Anthony Melton. We covered this in last week's show, but the reason that's an important date is that, well, Melton has not signed a contract yet, and we know the Rockets are preserving a portion of their mid-level exception that's basically earmarked for Melton. The idea is that if you use your MLE for a young player like Melton, the benefit to the team is that you get them on a 3-year deal, meaning 3 years of cheap labor, rather than the standard 2 if you're giving them the minimum salary exception. So while it's obviously to the benefit of the Rockets to sign Melton for a portion of the mid-level exception, as far as D'Anthony is concerned, a guy who could have been a first-round pick, maybe even a lottery pick, under better circumstances, he knows the mid-level exception for the Rockets can go all the way up to $4, even $5 billion in terms of the value. So he would, in a perfect world, get more than just the minimum. And he'll probably get more, in my estimation, than just the minimum. The question is, how much more? And, of course, like any negotiation, he needs leverage. And that required tender offer that the Rockets have to offer by September 5th to retain his rights, that's a big deal, because should he sign that, then he enters restricted free agency next summer, able to get outside contract offers, and, well, if it's above the MLE, the Rockets as a tax-paying team wouldn't even be able to keep him, even though he's restricted. They wouldn't be able to match, but quite frankly, even if it's not at the MLE level or higher, it would be a lot more expensive than signing him for a small portion of the MLE would be this summer. So clearly, that would be leverage against the Rockets. I don't think Melton actually wants to sign for the one-year tender, because the Rockets are such a good team that it's going to be tough for him or any unproven player to earn minutes on a team with this kind of expectations to contend for a title. So I don't know if he wants to gamble on himself quite to that extent where he would actually do it. But just as Clint Capella's team used the qualifying offer as leverage, I think that's what D'Anthony Melton's team is looking to do with this required tender, which he will have that offer as of September 5th. This is not that uncommon. The last high-profile second-round pick where this essentially loophole could have applied to the Rockets was Montrezl Harrell. That was in 2015, and his deal did not get done until September 15th. So, as I've said before, I do think the Rockets will get a deal done with Melton for the mid-level exception. I don't think he signs for the tender, but it probably takes until after September 5th, or at least very close to then, when Melton has his leverage in the form of the potential of signing for that required tender, because that's when he could hold the Rockets' feet to the fire, so to speak, and finally apply some pressure from his end. So that's something to watch as September 5th gets close. However, there's also a date even sooner than that that could also have relevance to the Rockets, and that's September 1st. Now, it doesn't have direct relevance to the Rockets, but basically what September 1st means in NBA circles, it's a date in which the math becomes more economical for players to be waived and stretched, cut, bought out, whatever you want to call it. For example, with the Knicks, we have heard for months that they plan to release, to buy out Joakim Noah, but they're not doing it until September 1st. And the reason for that, there are certain accounting advantages, basically in terms of how the money is put onto future salary caps. It's more advantageous to wait until September 1st to release that player. Effectively, his cap hit on your books next summer, which is when a lot of teams plan to be very active in free agency, is in a better position than if you had done it, say, before September 1st. So that's why the Knicks are waiting with Joakim Noah. And while theoretically the math would be the same no matter when you were to cut a player like that, the reason it could serve as a trigger for deals to happen quickly is that, in theory, the player is probably going to be more willing to give back money in a buyout if you do it in September as opposed to sometime during the season. Because if you do it in September, it's before the season, the player can survey the landscape, he gets a chance to go to training camp with his new team. Because he's in training camp with that team, he has a better chance to make the rotation, presumably increase his future earning power. So the argument is that if Joakim Noah gets bought out on September 1st, September 2nd, whatever it may be, that's when he's going to be most likely to give back the most money. In other words, there's no reason to wait. There's no upside. There's only potential downside. And if you don't really see the player as a part of your future, you may as well just get the deal done, especially when the only way that it could get, that the situation could change, would be to your detriment. Now, I don't think the Rockets would be a player for Joakim Noah. However, there could be other situations around the NBA which could be fits. As I've mentioned plenty over the past few weeks, I don't think the Rockets are done, be it a Ryan Anderson trade, be it buyouts during the season. The Rockets have most of their mid-level exception. I do think the Rockets are looking to bring in at least one more 3-and-D wing, and one player that presumably could be a fit would be Luol Deng in Los Angeles, who the Lakers would love to clear his salary off the books to give them more flexibility next summer. And the math on Deng is fairly similar to what the math is for the Knicks with Joakim Noah. Both Noah and Deng have big deals that expire in 2020, and so after September 1st, they're deemed to have just one remaining year on their contracts after the current season, which makes the salary cap figures, when waived under the stretch provision, more advantageous for cap room next summer. Now, would Deng be a fit for the Rockets? I was initially skeptical, and still am to some degree. It's been a couple of years since Deng was an effective NBA player. Didn't really get much run last year at all in Los Angeles, although that was a bit of a weird situation. But in general, while Deng at times has been a very good defender, fact is, now in his 30s, he's probably too slow to be a traditional small forward. He probably has to be a small ball 4 or 5. And with the Rockets losing Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute, my initial thought was that the guys to replace them, you probably want more flexibility, guys that can guard wings. That's why I've suggested guys like Kent Bazemore, Courtney Lee, those type. That said, if you squint hard enough, you can make a case that, look, the Rockets have 3 guards that can occupy all 96 minutes there every game, in Chris Paul, James Harden, and Eric Gordon. Of course, you can play some as a small ball 3 at times, but beyond those 3, you also have 2 guys in Michael Carter-Williams and De'Anthony Melton that you could make cases for potentially having a role even as soon as this season. Of course, you have James Ennis at the 3 spot. So if you squint hard enough, you can say, look, we feel better than we did just a few months ago in terms of wing defense for quicker players, and maybe you do have more questions up front. Because outside of P.J. Tucker, Clint Capela, and Carmelo Anthony, well, first, P.J. and Carmelo are both in their 30s, but after that, there's a lot of questions. Ryan Anderson, I think the Rockets see him, even if they keep him, as a 5 only at this stage of his career, and I don't even know that they really want to play him at this point. Nene is 36 years old, seemed to be on the decline last year. Isaiah Hartenstein, Joe Chi, very unproven. So if you squint hard enough, you could see a case where if Luol Deng were waived and stretched and presumably available for the minimum, you could see the Rockets taking a flyer on him, especially because if they get him for the minimum, it's not like you're losing any of your resources in terms of the mid-level exception to use on buyouts later in the season that are better than Luol Deng. You'd still have the Ryan Anderson contract to potentially use as salary filler on another deal, so it wouldn't be like you're committing to Luol Deng. It would be just basically like a trial run. By the way, I want to give credit to Mark Deeks, a salary capologist based out of the UK, who first floated this in an article on Give Me Sport. The possibility of not just the Lakers waving and stretching Luol Deng once you get to September, but also the Rockets being a potential fit for him. But the point is, it doesn't have to be Luol Deng. That's one example of a guy who September 1st may mean a lot to, but the same applies, as stated with Joakim Noah and the Knicks, and that could apply in other situations around the league as well. So while there's no situation that I see imminently set to impact the Rockets, a player that Daryl Morey will clearly go after if and when he gets his freedom, it's a date that carries a little more significance, especially now because there are so many bloated contracts set to expire in July 2020. And so that September 1st day, when effectively the collective bargaining agreement sees them as having just 1 year left following this current season, with so many of those big salaries on the books expiring in 2020, that could make September 1st, 2018, a bigger deal than it has been in past years. So again, nothing imminent, just something to keep your eye on in the days ahead, the same way, again, September 5th is a key date as far as D'Anthony Melton, rookie guard out of USC, and the Rockets being given required to give him a required tender offer 1 year at the minimum in order to retain his rights. So with that, we will wrap up. As always, thanks to you guys, our loyal listeners, for tuning in. If you want more content before the next show, the best place to get it is on Twitter. I'm on there at Ben Dubose, simply my name. Show is on there at Locked On Rockets. And also, don't forget, we've got an email address, lockedonrockets@gmail.com, a website at lockedonrockets.com, Facebook account at facebook.com/lockedonrockets. Always, you can ask me questions about the team, make suggestions for the show, access our prior content. Anything we can do to make this a better podcast for you, the diehard Rockets fan community, we would absolutely love to hear from you. Also, if you haven't subscribed to us already, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, etc., please do. That's how you're able to get our episodes right when they come out. You get alerts. And if you would also be kind enough to not just subscribe, but leave us a 5-star review, that's how we can look attractive to potential advertisers and keep the business model working here at Locked On Rockets and across the Locked On Podcast Network as the most regular podcast covering teams such as your Houston Rockets. Also here in Houston, besides the Rockets, that also includes the Houston Texans. We have a podcast, Locked On Texans, hosted by my friends Robert Land and Brian Patterson, covering them on a daily basis as they gear up for their regular season, starting just over a week from now. So while the NBA is a little bit quiet, if you want more content on a league that's a little more active in terms of the day-to-day, please check out Locked On Texans and give them a 5-star rating and subscription as well, if you could. So for now, this will do it for today's show. Again, thanks for tuning in, and stay tuned as we roll into September, the month in which the 2018-2019 season officially begins for the Rockets, with training camp just about 3 weeks away. For now, enjoy your extended Labor Day weekend, and we'll be talking again very soon right here at Locked On Rockets, your home for podcast analysis of Houston Rockets basketball.